Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we take you to a talk at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with Ambassador Anne Hall. The title of today's talk is The Baltics, Lessons in Courage. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast.
So good afternoon and welcome to members and guests here today and to those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 466th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, and it comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine. I'm George Look. The Midcoast Forum was founded over 40 years ago to hear an invited speaker each month on an issue related to U.S. foreign policy. You can listen to audios of past forum talks and get information about upcoming forum speakers on our website, midcoastforum.org. Recent forum talks are also on the website, sites of Maine Public Radio and the Maine Monitor. If you're interested in staying informed about key foreign affairs issues, or if you're just a guest here today, please consider becoming a member of the forum. Our membership form is on the forum's website. Our speaker today is Ambassador Anne Hall, who will be speaking on the Baltics, Lessons in Courage. Anne Hall served as a U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Lithuania from September 2016 until July of 2019. Prior to that, she served as the acting principal deputy assistant secretary of state for oceans and environmental and scientific affairs. Ambassador Hall was a career member of the Senior Foreign Service and has broad experience in Europe. In 2013 and 2014, she served as the director of the Office of Central European Affairs in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs. In that capacity, she was responsible for managing relations with Austria, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Liechtenstein, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and Switzerland. Quite a portfolio. From 2010 to 2013, she served as Deputy Chief of Mission and as Chargé d'Affaires at the American Embassy in Vilnius, Lithuania. From 2006 to 2009, Ambassador Hall was Principal Officer and Consul General of the American Consulate in Krakow, Poland. Ambassador Hall also served as a Senior Cyprus Country Officer in the Office of Southern European Affairs and the Country Officer for Norway and Denmark in the Office of Nordic and Baltic Affairs. So she has extremely broad experience in Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe and Northern Europe. Ambassador Hall had several other positions in the State Department in Washington and served, in addition to the Lithuania, she served overseas in China, Brazil, and Colombia. She is a recipient of several superior and meritorious honor awards. In July 2009, she became the first American Consul General to be awarded the Knight's Cross of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Poland. She speaks Lithuanian, Polish, Mandarin Chinese, Spanish, and Portuguese, and in a few minutes you'll see she also speaks English. She graduated from the University of Maine and received a master's degrees from the University of Texas. Anne, I'd like to welcome you to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George, for that lovely welcome. I have to say most of my languages are probably a little rusty at this point, but it sounds good. It's really a great honor and a privilege to be here today to talk with you all about the Baltics. This year they celebrate 20 years membership in both NATO and the European Union. They joined the European Union on May 1st, 2004, and I think NATO was March 29th, if I recall correctly. So it's a good time to be talking about this. I'll try to give a little bit of a brief overview of the Baltics, a little bit of history, a little kind of give you a sense of the place, and then I'll give you a few examples of why I see them as real profiles in courage and worth, in some ways, learning from for all of us. Since they joined NATO and the European Union, the Baltics, all of them have undergone tremendous, tremendous transformations, economic, political, and certainly defense transformations. And today, although they're small countries, they have real niche capabilities, and they're valued allies and partners and friends of the United States. They vote with us in the United Nations. They all served in Afghanistan, and they brought what capabilities they could to that. Lithuania actually led a provincial reconstruction team in Gore province. They tend to punch above their weight wherever they go. They're serious, they're dedicated, and they're highly trained, certainly defense partners. They've recently achieved, and I'll talk about this a little more later, independence from Russian gas, from Gazprom, and soon they will be independent from the Russian electrical grid. These things have taken years to accomplish, but those are reflective of the drive that they have to be independent and maintain their sovereignty. Lithuania most recently has become the destination of choice for American companies that are looking to expand in Europe, perhaps beyond Germany, or create a footprint in Europe for the first time. And that's because there's a highly, highly educated workforce there, very low corruption. It's one of those things that, you know, joining the European Union and NATO requires countries to undertake a number of reforms, and that in every case, over time, greatly it strengthens the rule of law and reduces corruption. And so as a result, you see a lot of companies wanting to go in and work there. And then they also have, compared to, say, Germany or France, competitive wages. These are small countries. The population of Lithuania is just about 2.8 million. Latvia, under 2 million. Estonia, 1.37 million. All of them share a border with Russia. Latvia and Estonia, it's along their eastern border, and while Lithuania is sort of sandwiched between Kaliningrad on its west, which is a Russian exclave, it's Russian, it's basically a big military base, now it has nuclear weapons, but that's a whole other story, and then Belarus to their east. Both Estonia and Latvia have significant ethnic Russian populations. About 25% of the population in Latvia is Russian. In Estonia, it's about 20%. That said, well, most of them, though, have EU passports. About 85% of them have EU passports. They maintain ties with Russia. They may have family there. They certainly have cultural affinity to Russia, but most of them want that EU passport. Lithuania is quite different. Lithuania, Russian population is only about 7% of its overall population, and there's an ethnic Polish population in Lithuania that's about 6%, and that's interesting because it differs very, very differs politically from Poles in Poland, because the ethnic Polish population in Lithuania gets its news from Russian language media, and it acts politically often more like the Russian, even more Russian than sort of the ethnic Russians. And there's a long and complex history to that, and it's at times it's rather fraught. So let's look at a few important historical events for a moment. The cornerstone of the American relationship with the Baltics is the Wells Declaration of 1940. And in it, at that time, then Secretary of State Sumner Wells condemned the Soviet occupation of the three Baltic states, and he declared that the United States did not recognize their annexation into the Soviet Union. And that meant their embassies flew their flags all through the Cold War. I can't overstate how important this is to people in the Baltics. They remember it. They celebrate it every year. There's a square in Vilnius named the Sumner Wells Square. People turn out, they have speakers and bands, and people walking around the city just come and they sit down and they celebrate the fact that we never recognized them as part of the Soviet Union. The second most important part of history, I think, to be aware of is the Baltic Way. And this was when on August 23rd, 1989, about 2 million people from across the three Baltic countries joined hands, and they created a human chain that stretched 430 miles from Vilnius to Tallinn, and they sang songs, because all of these cultures are very musical. And they did this to support, to draw public opinion and public support for Baltic independence. And also, I should say, there. Not surprisingly, the date was chosen to mark the 50th anniversary of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So not much happened immediately after the Baltic Way, something also that those countries still celebrate today. It's a huge part of their identity. But 7 months later, in March of 1990, Lithuania became the first of the Soviet republics to declare its independence. And then Latvia and Estonia soon followed. Just about a few months later, well, let me back up. A few days later, Lithuania just declared independence on March 11th. On March 15th, the Russians started putting economic and political pressure on Lithuania. Eventually, winter came, and during that winter, they imposed an economic blockade. People still remember that if they lived through it. You couldn't get food in the stores. Most importantly, they cut off the gas. And so homes were cold, and it was a really cold winter. And then in January of 1991, the Red Army, which was, you know, still sitting in the forests outside of every city in Lithuania, left their barracks. And they moved into the major cities, Vilnius and the others, in an attempt to overthrow the newly elected government and return Lithuania, obviously, to the Soviet orbit. They quickly moved to cut off the means of communication, taking TV towers and things like that, and they surrounded the parliament. And the Lithuanians turned out en masse, and they brought buses. They surrounded parliament with buses. They tore up huge, huge pieces of concrete from the street, and they built barricades around that parliament. And if you go to that parliament today, you'll see pieces of it that they've kind of enshrined as part of this memory. 14 people died, 140 people were injured. After about a day and a half or so, President Bush called President Gorbachev and told him to back off. It took a little time because we were in the midst of detente and working closely with Russia, but that made a difference as well. And eventually they withdrew and they returned to their barracks. And I think it's also worth noting, though, that the roughly 30,000 Russian soldiers that were in the Baltics at the time of their independence in 1991 didn't actually leave until 1993. That's how long it took to negotiate their withdrawal from the Baltics. So all the time these countries are, you know, independent, by that time they're members of the United Nations, they're internationally recognized, you've got thousands and thousands of Russian soldiers with all their tanks and all their equipment just hanging out in the forest, and everybody knows where they are. And you can go there today and see the remnants of what they left. And so this history lives on today in the national, in the memories. It's part of their national identity, and it's the memories of the people. And they come out, and they celebrate it, and they remember it, and they're incredibly proud of it. And while Second World War is a distant memory for us, it's always important to remember when dealing with the Baltics, or Poland for that matter, for them it ended in 1990. And that's not very long ago. So, moving forward to more recent history, I mentioned a little bit about their accomplishments. Vibrant economies, strong education system, lots of innovation. Skype, you know, was created by the Estonians. And some of you, there's a NordVPN that's Lithuanian. All spend, and I'll talk about this later, but all meet the NATO threshold for spending and have greatly surpassed it. All three look to us within NATO as the guarantors of their security. Just a few highlights. Something is important to know about Estonia. For many people, the first time they really heard about Estonia was in 2007 when Russia launched a major cyber attack against Estonia and shut down all of their major government institutions, foreign ministry, among others. After that, and Estonia was actually rather technologically advanced country, but after that, they worked very hard to investigate what had happened and put in place mechanisms to better protect for it in the future. And their efforts were recognized by NATO when a few years later, NATO put what they call a cyber center of excellence in Estonia that works on cyber issues closely with NATO. Estonia's language is similar to Finnish, so they tend to consider themselves more Nordic, and they tend to look north and work closely with Finland. Latvia has a very different character. Both Latvia and Riga's ports were part of the Hanseatic League. There's a lot of German architecture, but Riga was a very important city in Imperial Russia, And there is still a strong sense of, I would say, that part of their history in Riga. And at least, I don't know what it's like now. I think it's actually changed quite a bit since Russia went deeper into Ukraine. But for many, many years, there were actually strong ties between some of the Latvian ethnic Russian leaders and Putin's United Russia Party, and a lot of corruption in their energy sector related to Russia. And so that's always been kind of a problem in Latvia more than it has been in either Estonia or Lithuania. In the predominantly ethnic Russian areas of Latvia, they tend to be kind of blue-collar. In Lithuania, there are very few Russians, but those that were there were brought in to work in a Chernobyl-era nuclear power plant, and they're all very highly educated. Lithuania's history is very different. During the 16th and 17th century, Lithuania was part of what's called the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. It's not something we study, but I highly recommend to you. I mean, it's an amazing period of time, which I could talk about forever. There's a wonderful series of books about them that's been beautifully translated into English, but, you know, Tartars invading and all sorts of stuff. It's kind of fascinating time. But that Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth extended, it included what today is Ukraine. It extended from the Black Sea to the Baltic Sea, and it was the wealthiest entity in Europe at the time. It had the grain trade that all moved from sort of Odessa up through their rivers. Over the course of the 18th century, it was gradually, chunks of it were taken by Russia, Prussia, and Austro-Hungarian Empire until it ceased to exist by 1795. But because of that that sort of history, Lithuania very much looks south. It works closely with Poland most of the time. They have their sibling sort of issues, but that's their orientation, unlike Estonia that looks north. You know, Lithuania has a world-class biosciences sector. Thermo Fisher Scientific has a really important, for them, very important R&D center there, and it's building off the Soviet legacy of important biosciences expertise, and also Teva, for example, the Israeli pharmaceutical company is there. And they've also become more recently European center of fintech. And they also make some of the finest lasers in the world. Our special ops forces, night vision goggles, for example, use lasers that are made in Lithuania. So each of these countries have some important little niches. They're driven, their education systems are very strong, and they work hard. So I've talked about perhaps some of the differences, but what they all share in common is their experience with Russia and their knowledge of Russia. And over the years, the United States, UK, and others, but have benefited tremendously from learning from their assessment from Russia. And we work very closely with them in many ways to better understand from their point of view what they're seeing and what's happening. You know, for example, in 2016, after our presidential election, I was there as ambassador, and we received an unprecedented number of congressional delegations to Lithuania. Most of them went to Lithuania first and then on to Ukraine. All of them were either bipartisan, led by Republicans, or entirely Republican delegations. And all of them had the same message. They all met with Lithuanian government and other, you know, parliamentary officials. And they said, notwithstanding what you may have heard during our campaign, we honor our commitments and we support NATO. And we're here to convey that to you and to reassure you, but we're also here to better understand from you what you're seeing Russia do in your neighborhood and how we can learn from your experience and your reaction and work together. And we're Congress and we matter. I mean, that was literally over and over what they said. I think there were something like 19 visits, and that's unusual for that part of the world. So I'll talk a little bit about the US-NATO presence. And so Russia first went into Crimea in 2014. Actually, let me back up, because this is one of my favorite, honest, frankly, memories. In 2008, when Russia invaded Georgia, I was living in Poland. And there was a park near my house, and I used to walk in that park. And there was an elegant, elderly Polish woman who spoke a beautiful, elegant Polish, and she had lost her brothers in the Second World War. I'm not quite sure how old she was, but she was amazing. And I remember it was that first weekend after Russia went into Georgia, and this woman said, "Crimea will be next. That's where he'll go. Watch the Crimea." And I didn't see anything mentioning that, the likelihood that he would go into Crimea next, in U.S. papers for a long time. They know, it's in their DNA, they understand Russia far better, I think, than we ever will. So moving forward, after Russia went into Crimea in 2014, illegally annexed Crimea, NATO held a summit in Wales. You know, it's one of their scheduled summits. And they decided to do something that no one, I think, ever thought we would see. Well, except for planners, perhaps. But they decided to put what they called an enhanced forward presence in Poland in the Baltics, meaning a NATO battle group, a battalion in each of those countries. That would take a while, obviously, to stand up. And so in the interim, we agreed, the United States, that we would have a smaller presence, a company-sized presence in each country. And why did we do that? Because after Russia annexed Crimea, the Poles and, well, the Romanians and others for that matter, but the Baltics especially, as former parts of the Soviet Union, and listening and understanding Putin and his rhetoric, felt very strongly that we needed some sort of American presence, even if very small, in their countries, because they believed that Putin would not cross the border if there were American boots on the ground. And so that's what we did. When I got there, for example, we had a company of the 101st Airborne in Lithuania. So today we have Lithuania has about 1,200 NATO troops there, and they're led by, it's a multinational force with many different NATO countries led by the Germans. And then there are another additional 1,000 American troops in Lithuania as well. Lithuania spends, you know, you probably all know that the NATO members are expected to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense spending. Lithuania spends 2.5% and is committed to reaching 3% by the end of the decade. And they're also pressing others to get up to 3%. Last summer, there was a NATO summit in Vilnius, and the Germans actually committed to deploying an additional 4,000 troops to Lithuania bilaterally. And right now, Lithuania doesn't have a place for them, but they're working to prepare an old Soviet base over sort of near Belarus where they would be located. There's a lot of old unexplored ordnance there that they need to clean up, and it's going to take some time. Estonia also has about 1,200 NATO troops led by Britain, about 650 rotational troops, U.S. troops. They spend about 2.7% of their GDP on defense. Latvia is similar. Their NATO presence is led by Canada. They spend about 2.3% of their GDP on defense. And although we're not talking about Poland, but the U.S. leads the NATO presence in Poland, and they spend well over 3% on their defense. And we also have a very large bilateral presence in Poland. So also, I should mention, some of you may know that the focus of much of the defense planning in that part of the world is on something called the Suwalki Gap. And the Suwalki Gap refers to the very narrow border between Lithuania and Poland. And, you know, and you have Lithuania up here, Poland down here, Kaliningrad, Belarus, and this little border that's only 40 miles wide. And so the concern has always been that if Russia were to move from Belarus or Kaliningrad, for that matter, either way, they could close that gap very, very quickly and sever NATO. And so when you think about it, it's very hard to defend the Baltics under that sort of scenario. They could have been overrun very quickly. And so, needless to say, for the Baltics, seeing Sweden and Finland join NATO and understanding how that radically changed the NATO's ability to defend them was cause for great jubilation. I mean, they were just elated to see the Finns and the Swedes join. Just a few other things too, just to get in a little bit to NATO. You know, beyond what they spend on GDP or how much they spend it, how they spend it is important. And they spend a lot on infrastructure. There's a certain amount you have to spend on salaries, but they all go way over and above that. And they invest hundreds of millions of dollars into upgrading their own ranges. And they do as much as they possibly can because they're so driven to be safe, quite frankly. And they also want us there. They want us to be able to come and train there. So these ranges have to meet our readiness criteria as well. And so there are a lot of reasons that they're good partners. Right now, they're working to create something called the Baltic Defense Line. And it was an initiative just announced in February. And they're planning hundreds of bunkers along the border with Russia, as well as clear cutting and pre-positioning ammunition and all sorts of stuff, just in the event that at some point Russia decides that he could take a bite out of the Baltics. I think another thing that's important to mention is all of these countries for years have been subjected to very sophisticated propaganda and disinformation efforts by Russia. Russia never really stopped doing that in the Baltics. They're very good at it. And the Balts are very adept at recognizing it and reacting to it, and they teach something called media literacy in their schools, which is an effort to teach young people how to discern fact from fiction. Rather than just accepting a meme on Facebook, go to the source, check it out, because there's a lot of that stuff out there, and we work very closely with them in this area. Again, because what Russia tends to do, whether it's cyber aggression or misinformation, you see it first in Ukraine, now it's war, but before that you'd see it first in Ukraine and then you'd see it in the Baltics, and we worked hard to learn from them. So I'm going to tell you just about two other little parts of the history there or recent history that I think are important, and then I think it'll be time to, George gave me 35 minutes, so I'll stay within that. And plus, I would hope you'd all be eating, so I don't want to keep you from your lunch. They should be serving you. I mentioned earlier that the Baltics have achieved independence from Gazprom, and that's quite a story, and quite an accomplishment. In the 2010s, Gazprom was charging the Baltic countries the highest prices for gas in Europe, and among those, charging Lithuania the highest prices, in part because Lithuania had sued Gazprom in European court for monopolistic pricing. So around that time, the European Union was planning to put an LNG terminal somewhere, a floating terminal somewhere along the coast, maybe Estonia, maybe Croatia, trying to decide where to put it. So Lithuania being Lithuania, this is very much in their character, said, we're not going to wait around for you guys. We are going to have our own LNG terminal. So they negotiated a 10-year contract with a Norwegian company to lease and build a floating LNG terminal. The terminal was built by Samsung in South Korea, was towed over, and in 2015, Lithuania had its own LNG terminal, and they named it, in English, Independence. And then they created a spot market for gas comprising the Baltics and Finland, and they forced Russia to play in the market and offer market prices. And then they set about importing LNG. They really wanted to buy American LNG. And this gives you a sense of their character. They bought Norwegian, they could buy from Qatar, but they wanted American, they wanted Chevron. Well, and they kept coming to me saying, can you help? Well, the U.S. government does not get involved in those sorts of negotiations. Those are entirely private sector, market-driven. Lithuania is a small buyer. Chevron's a big company. It took a long time. Eventually, they were buying Chevron gas. But it took at least a couple of years. So at that time, they were still buying about 30% of their gas from Russia, but at market prices. But since Russia went further into Ukraine, they've stopped even that. And now they are 100% independent from Gazprom, which gives them a tremendous sense of accomplishment and security. And the other thing that is kind of interesting is in 2021, Lithuania, because Lithuania is a great champion of sort of country striving for freedom. They've been very supportive of Georgia. They were very supportive of Ukraine for years in many different ways. So they allowed Taiwan, and they were becoming frustrated with a mechanism that China had set up with Central European countries, ostensibly to promote trade, but they felt it was just a big sort of propaganda effort for China. So they decided to leave that group, and they decided to allow Taiwan to open a representative office in Lithuania. And they decided to let Taiwan call it the Taiwanese Representative Office in Lithuania. Not surprisingly, China reacted. They withdrew their ambassador from Lithuania. They told Lithuania they would have to shut down their embassy or withdraw their ambassador. So they did. They still have an embassy, but no ambassador. But most importantly, they imposed a blockade on all imports from Lithuania or of imports from other countries that had components made in Lithuania. That's a lot of German goods, because Germany does a lot of manufacturing now in Lithuania. Certain sensors for cars and things like that for German products are made in Lithuania. So, I mean, for a while, and this was a big deal in Europe, everybody was sort of talking about it, and for a while, if you talk to the Chinese would say, oh, no, nothing's happened, you know. But apparently, the country, Lithuania, disappeared from their customs list of countries around the world. There was no more Lithuania. So it was impossible to import everything from Lithuania because the country no longer exists in their computers. That's what they did. Our Exim Bank gave them about $500 million in loan guarantees to shore up their economy. But the real story here is the Lithuanians didn't buckle, and they withstood the economic pressure. Eventually, Chinese business wanted some of these components. And eventually it started to weaken a little bit. And lo and behold, although the Chinese economy took a hit a little bit at first, their economy continued to grow. And it continued to grow at rates faster than most of Europe. And that's generally the case with all the countries in the Baltics. And the other thing they did is they immediately said, well, we're going to diversify in Asia. And their only embassy and their focus on trade had been China. They opened embassies in Canberra and in Seoul and in Singapore. And this is a little tiny country. And they said, we're just going to keep going forward because, by God, we were the first to leave the Soviet Union, and China will not make us back down. I mean, that's the spirit of Lithuania and of the Baltics in general. So the last thing I'll leave you with goes back to Putin and all that we're seeing him do today. And I think it was 2017, the president of Lithuania, Dalia Grybauskaitė, who was quite a force. She was elected to 2 5-year terms and became a good friend. And she was a real child of the Soviet Union. And she said, Putin will go as far as we let him, because that's what makes life interesting for him. Simple. That's what he will do, you know. And I think she's been proven correct. So with that, I guess I'll open it up for questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ambassador Hall. Very interesting. I think we tend not to think very much about the Baltic states, and we need to think more about them. They're small but mighty,
as you
said.
That's a good point.
We collect now questions that our members and guests have, and I always take the opportunity to ask the first question. I wanted to have you expand a little bit on something you said at the very end. Do you see Russia, given the history of Russia and the Baltics, do you see Russia as trying to bring the Baltic states back into the Russian sphere? And if so, how do you think they might do that?
Oh, that's a good question. That's the question of the day, isn't it? I think as it stands right now, I think it would be unlikely that they would try to do so. Certainly they would like to have influence. There's no question. I can talk a little bit about that, although I think I touched on it. But I think as it stands right now, given they have probably all they can handle right now in Ukraine, and they're also looking at a NATO that's very, very unified as it's been in any of our memories, and committed to the defense of Europe. But I think absolutely, if Putin thought that he could, in some fashion, could be a hybrid fashion, it wouldn't have to be with tanks, but in some fashion, invade the Baltics without NATO responding, if NATO were no longer as unified as it is today, if he thought that we would not support a NATO reaction, then I think absolutely he would. I think if he thought he could get away with it, yeah, absolutely he would.
Can the Baltics be defended?
They can be defended better now with the entrance of Sweden and Finland into the into NATO than previously. Until that time, you would have been fighting a war of resistance in the Baltics. NATO, Russia could have overrun the Baltics very quickly, and NATO has wonderful plans for how to obviously eventually retake the Baltics, but it would have taken time and they would have been overrun. And I should add that we've had our special operations forces there now for quite some years, working very closely with the very capable Lithuanian special operations forces, and the focus is on resistance. And the Baltics, the people in the Baltics fought in the forests against the Russians into the 1950s. And, they're incredibly, the Lithuanian special ops are as capable as you could find anywhere. And so we've been working with them for quite a while in all different ways. But we work with FEMA comes over to help cities, organize for all sorts of defense scenarios. So it's very hard, but better likelihood of defending, much better now that Sweden and Finland have joined Norway. And
someone wanted to ask, if Russia were to move into the Baltics, what do you think their strategy would be? To pick off the countries one at a time, or try to, you talked about different histories and different relationships with Russia.
Oh, I think generally the thought was that they would, as I said, they would close the Suwalki Gap, and that would be enough to put NATO in a position where it would either have to respond or not respond, and you go through that. They'd have to respond, presumably declare Article 5, but it would be very hard for NATO to get to it. I mean, generally the thought was that there's a road that comes from sort of Russia's Western Military District right straight down into Latvia, and from there it's a straight shot to Vilnius. And so the thought always was that it would do that. Estonia would be isolated. They could pick off Estonia, and it could be very, very fast. But now that calculation, thank goodness, is a little different.
Then a couple of questions here on how much coordination there is between the three countries. How close are they? Are they really, three separate countries, or one country,
really good
three
question.
Parts?
We would always like them to be closer. Joint procurement things like that. It's hard. They are three separate countries with three separate political systems, and they work together very well in some ways, in other ways, not so. So it's, it always could be better. But then on the other hand, I always say for example, when we invite, there was a time, and I suspect we still do this, when the Nordics wanted a meeting in Washington, we would say, well, let's have all three Baltic presidents, when the Baltics wanted a meeting, we'd have all three Baltic presidents come to meet with President whomever, and they'd come in a group. But we never said to Denmark or Norway or Sweden, well, we'll only meet with you if you all come together, right? So, sometimes I think we expect too much.
Then someone here, I was asked if you'd elaborate a little bit on what would happen if there was a Europe without NATO. Can it really be another Soviet Union?
I mean, look at Ukraine, look at Moldova. And we didn't mention Moldova, but that would be easy. That would be the easiest. I mean, you can't even imagine. NATO it's defensive, but it also is it brings together Europe in a format that enables Europeans to work through all of the issues that are related to defense. For example, we don't, at least we didn't a few years ago, have enough HETs, the huge vehicles that transport tanks, to get them across Europe, right? So if NATO has to defend the Baltics, how are you going to get the tanks there? And then what roads will support those tanks, right? That's the other thing. So NATO working with the European Union a few years ago got the EU to come up with a plan and millions of euros to start reinforcing those roads and things like that. So there's a whole lot of synergy that occurs between NATO and the EU because of the existence of NATO. I mean, it's the most successful defense alliance, I mean, in world history, and we wouldn't have Europe today without it in the same way.
Well, let's go the opposite direction. Can or should NATO be expanded to include an economic union, or how can we help bring the European countries closer together?
I don't think NATO would want to expand its remit in more into economic areas, and I mean that's well covered. I mean that's really the purview of the European Union, and they have all of the mechanisms that are in place. That said, there's always, you know, cooperation between NATO and Union takes different forms at different times, and so that's very much something that they all work on together, because certainly robust, prosperous European economies are critical for NATO, for NATO's success as well. Europe, in many ways, I would say Ukraine has united Europe in ways that we hadn't seen for a long time. And there's nothing, obviously, to say something very trite, but there's nothing like a common enemy. There are certainly distinctions in Europe between, I think it was Secretary Rumsfeld who referred to New Europe and Old Europe, and there really is a difference. Those countries that have joined the European Union more recently, and NATO for that matter, that were all part of the Soviet sphere, whether it was part of the Soviet Union or part of the Warsaw Pact, do have different views, and in many cases, not all cases, but in some cases, a lot of fiscal discipline. They can sometimes be a little critical of some of the countries in Southern Europe who they feel need to, get their house in order and contribute properly to NATO and make the tough economic decisions that some of those countries have made. So it's a large alliance, and it's always going to have its challenges. But certainly, I would say today, it's working about as well as we've seen it. And not to talk too long, but there's also an increased awareness in Europe of the threats posed by China, and an awareness of that they need to perhaps be very careful about the way in which they engage in their relationships with China. So this is all, it all continues to evolve.
Let's stick on the NATO theme for a second, but let's talk about NATO and history. In some quarters, it's believed that the expansion of NATO led to Putin's becoming more aggressive, and therefore a strategic mistake. True, not true?
Well, if there's one argument that frankly gets my back up, it's that one. Because there are a lot of problems with that. People that I know that worked on it very closely would say they worked, and actually some documents were recently declassified in the National Archive from the 1990s that focus on our negotiations with Russia. So did we perhaps make some mistakes? Did we sometimes miscalculate, perhaps? But the people working with Russia were working very, very hard to coordinate very closely with Russia with relation to NATO for many years. And there was at one point in some corners, some even thought that Russia might eventually join NATO. But the biggest problem with putting the onus for what's happening in Ukraine today on NATO is that it doesn't take into account what the Ukrainians wanted. And there's a kind of a school of thought out there that, knowing consciously or unconsciously, sort of buys into this notion of old imperial Russia. And, you don't have to spend much time in Poland or the Baltics. Let's talk we won't even talk Warsaw Pact, but the Baltics, to understand that they don't They don't buy into it. And the Georgians don't want to be a part of it. The Ukrainians didn't want to be a part of it. And I think even Putin himself, increasingly, I mean, he hasn't talked over the last few months very much at all about this being the fault of NATO. This has gone way beyond that. And it's really, it's a clash between an authoritarian system and aspiring a democracy that's aspiring to be a member of the European Union and, you know, overcome the problems of corruption that it still has, just like every other formerly Soviet sphere or Warsaw Pact country has done, and to become a flourishing democracy today. But yeah, that's, that probably said enough.
And a couple of questions related to Kaliningrad. How does Kaliningrad complicate the Baltic question, and can Russia defend Kaliningrad?
Again, with more difficulty, since now we have Norway and Sweden and Finland, you know, is part of NATO, because you can much more easily now, you can close off airspace, you can close off the Baltic Sea, and you can work to isolate Kaliningrad, and that wasn't the case previously. And they have very sophisticated air defenses, and it's possible for us to penetrate them, but it takes time. It just takes very specialized equipment on our part. But this has completely changed the equation, and makes Kaliningrad. It's still dangerous, but I think it makes it perhaps. I'm sure there's a lot of planning that's been going on in the last few months. Put it that way, because it's changed our capabilities.
You commented that there are now nuclear weapons in Kaliningrad. Does that complicate the situation?
I mean, they used to, I'm looking at Larry Butler, he's worked on this too over the years, but they used to bring them in and out for military exercises, and we would see when they would leave their bases or whatever in Russia, we would know when they would come in, and we would kind of know when they would go back. And then in recent years, my understanding is they've left them there. But I think it's something, you know, it's built in, it's, you live with it, and you know they're there, and it's built into the calculation. And the vaults, something very interesting, there is actually still a train that travels from Russia through Belarus, through Lithuania, to Kaliningrad. And this is a remnant of the agreements with Russia that were reached between Lithuania and Russia when the Soviet troops were withdrawing. And so that train still today runs right through Lithuania. It carries soldiers, it carries all sorts of stuff. It doesn't stop. But when it has to slow down to go through Vilnius, both sides of the tracks are covered with huge posters. This is what you're doing in Ukraine, and all sorts of information that the people can't help but see when they drive through. But that train still under international treaty has to go through. And the Lithuanians, when we first imposed sanctions and blockades on certain goods getting to Russia after they went further into Ukraine in 2022, the Lithuanians argued that train had to stop because they could no longer take those blockaded items in on that train. But under international law, they couldn't do that. So much to their disappointment, that train still runs. But they would have stopped it if they could have.
Then I apologize. This is always in logical order. But was the Baltic countries' defense spending that you've talked about a result of Trump putting pressure on NATO? Or was it happening before?
It was happening before. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it was happening. As a matter of fact, they were pressuring others themselves. Yeah, and it was happening in Poland. And again, most of the newer NATO members, it's not an issue. And what will happen, like I know, I was actually looking at the list the other day, and I noticed that France had been over the 2%, and it just dropped down to 1.9%. Occasionally, if you're looking at how much countries are spending, you'll see a country that's been 2% or above drop down a little bit. Sometimes what happens is their GDP grows faster than they expected. And that happened once when I was in Lithuania, and they said, oh, and the Lithuanians, though, they're like, you know, we will not allow for a day anyone to think that we're not meeting our obligations. So they quickly appropriated more money so that they could be certain that the percentage would keep up with their GDP growth.
And then a couple on the internal politics, et cetera, of the Baltics. You mentioned the high level of education in all three Baltic states. Could you speak to what has driven this effort and whether the efforts contain lessons for the rest of us?
I do think there's a legacy, a Soviet legacy in some of these countries of a very strict kind of old-fashioned, onerous education system. And I do think that's part of it. But then the rest of it is because they remember what life was like before 1990. And so there's a real drive to make sure that they achieve everything they can achieve, that they build that democracy, that they build their economies. They remember where they came from. And so there's a drive and a determination throughout those societies to work very hard. The level of education, of English language is very high. Frankly, you find that in Ukraine, too. It's extraordinary how well people speak English. It's a drive. It's a drive for excellence, and it's born, I suppose, in many ways out of a feeling of insecurity. They're small, and they know they have to achieve, and they have to work hard. And they also want to make sure, that they're good partners of the United States. They want American investment. They want American technology. They want American culture. They're very proud of their own. I don't mean to suggest that, but we, for them, are. They have always held the United States up as not just the guarantors of their security, but the kind of democracy that they wanted to achieve. And so, working in the Baltics and Poland too, for that matter, and I suspect elsewhere like Romania. But it's you feel as though it's a great privilege because there's still a great deal of work to be done. Those still countries are, well, all democracies require work, and theirs are, you know, still relatively young, and they're terrific partners, and they want you there. They want you there with them, kind of every step of the way. And it's not a dependence or neediness. It's just, this is what we're doing. We want to do it well. We want to get the best technology or the best advice. Can you bring somebody in? Can you bring in an expert? How do we do this? What's the best way? It's that drive.
And how about the internal politics of the Baltics? Are their politics less divisive than ours? Are they stable? The politics
in a word, yes. So far, yes. Yes.
So far.
Yeah. I mean, they haven't had, you know, like the sort of, some of you might follow what's happening in Hungary. They haven't had some of those problems. And I'm sure with no question with what's happening in Ukraine, that's made them probably, that would lessen the likelihood, I would suppose, of any discord. Although I would say during COVID, there were some demonstrations, anti-vaccine demonstrations in Vilnius, and that was actually interesting because that brought out some of the neo-Nazi elements. It was interesting. It was this confluence. There were kind of neo-Nazis, there was anti-Semitic language on posters and things, and then there were all these anti-vaxxers, and they were all there together. It actually got violent at one point. And within that crowd, not to say it's entirely because of the Russians, but there were some real known Russian agitators in that crowd. And that's the sort of thing Russia is, of course, very good at stoking and amplifying. They're very good, and we don't... One thing the Baltics are very good at recognizing is how Russia plays its hand and how it can take concerns within a society or, divisions within a society and use that for its own purposes. And I think having been in the Baltics and seeing how clearly they see it and how seriously they take it, I think that's one thing that I think we don't recognize enough in this country. I was, I'll probably talk too long, but I'll tell one last and perhaps end with this. I had a very senior Senate delegation from the Senate. It was Senate Appropriations Committee there. And one of the things we did is take them to a briefing by the person in the Lithuanian military that handles their efforts to identify and react to disinformation propaganda, and he's a brilliant guy. And this very, very, very senior Republican senator, whose name I won't mention, but he's been around a long time, leaned over and said, I have never seen a briefing that on this issue that is as outstanding as this one. And he said something like, said something after that, and kind of like why or you know something. And by then I'd spent enough time with him and felt comfortable enough, and I just leaned over and I said, smiled, and I said, well, here there's a consensus that there's a problem. And he just smiled and said, absolutely, you know, absolutely.
So I'm going to squeeze in one more question, okay, which is closely related to what you're just talking about. Do you think it's likely that a group of Republican congressmen in 2024 or 2025 would go to Europe and voice support for the Baltics or for Ukraine?
Senators, perhaps. Perhaps not so likely Congress these days. Although Congressman Mike Turner, he will. Absolutely, he's been there. Matter of fact, he's very, very aware, and he absolutely voices exactly those same things. I mean, he can't perhaps speak with the authority that they were able to a few years ago on what Congress would do, but he can speak for himself, and he's actually recently been very outspoken about his concerns about some of the Russian talking points that are showing up in our political discourse.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a discussion hosted by the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations with Ambassador Anne Hall. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.